Good day, listeners. Jonathan Daugherty here with a bonus edition of the Pure Sex Radio program. You know, we're a listener-supported outreach of Be Broken Ministries, and we exist to help individuals and families move from sexual brokenness to wholeness in Christ and equip others to do the same. In this episode, I chat with three amazing leaders from Prodigals International: Steve Delaney, who's the president of Prodigals; Sam Louie, a licensed mental health counselor; and Fausto Estrada, one of their group leaders. Steve shares how Prodigals International began as a faith-based support group for men struggling with sexual addiction and intimacy disorders, emphasizing the importance of community and accountability. Sam opens up about his journey from addiction to recovery, influenced by his background as an Asian immigrant. He highlights how group therapy and supportive mentors really transformed his life. Fausto shares his own recovery story and how it has culminated in him now leading a Spanish language support group for prodigals. Together, we explore the power of faith, personal stories, and the cultural context in overcoming addiction and fostering recovery. I trust that this conversation will inspire you in your own journey of pursuing greater integrity. To learn more about Prodigals, visit prodigalsinternational.org. For additional resources, visit bebroken.org or check out all the links that we're going to put in today's show notes, because there's actually a lot of resources that we're going to highlight. And of course, friends, rate and review the podcast after listening, because this really does help others to find it. Now, let's jump into today's rich conversation with Steve, Sam, and Fausto. Well, all right. We have Steve Delaney, Fausto Estrada, and Sam Louie with us. Good morning, guys. It's early for you guys. So yes. Welcome.
We're glad to be here, Jonathan.
Thank you. Yeah. So, Steve, why don't we start with you? Because, you're the president of Prodigals International, and that's kind of the ministry that we're going to be talking about. These couple of resources that Sam and Fausto will be sharing with us in a minute. But tell us a little bit more about Prodigals and kind of what you guys are doing, and then we're going to dive into these amazing stories of these guys.
Yeah, thanks again. Thanks for having us this morning. Prodigals started in late 90s. There was a group of men who were involved in a secular recovery program for porn, sex addiction, love addiction, which is called Sexaholics Anonymous. And they found that that particular program was not really meeting their needs. They were really looking for something that was faith-based. They were Christian men, and they'd found sort of a community of themselves going to this particular meeting. As a result of that, those guys really felt led to start something that was faith-based. And so they took the foundation of a 12-step program, Sexaholics Anonymous, and they built a framework and a curriculum and a new program around a Christian-based, faith-based 12-step program. And so that we were founded in 2000, and we launched that program in the state of Washington with one group, that group exponentially started to multiply. The foundation of that program really is, that it's really about the kingdom. And for men that are caught up in issues around sexually compulsive behavior, sexual addiction, love addiction, all these issues of really what we characterize as an intimacy disorder. I'm a mental health counselor. Those things really keep men from enjoying God's love and enjoying His Spirit. And it really keeps a wall between them and Jesus Christ. And through that process of that program really allows men to start to begin to thrive in Him. And so that was, the beginnings of the program. And since then, since 2000, multiplied to multiple groups, both in the state of Washington, Alaska, up in Canada. Fausto will be speaking about Canada and our groups up. We have a number of groups up in Calgary, and we have groups kind of scattered around the United States. And then, you know, about 5 years ago, we started an online group. I think you're aware of that. Started an online group so that men both in the United States and Canada and even internationally can participate in our program. The key thing that differentiates us is our accountability model. It's a really important and key piece that brings men to a place of being, you know, really being held to that level of accountability. And the other thing that differentiates us is that it's really about, for many men, they have tried other things. They've tried other programs, and for whatever reason, they have not been able to find success. And through our program, we see men being able to sort of be held to a, you know, a fairly high standard, right? But it's also grace-based. So we look at it from a loving, grace-filled perspective. But that really is what, you know, can be a challenge for a lot of men, because it kind of pushes them to, you know, really be involved in our program. So yeah, so we've had those elements. And then also, as the ministry grew, we offered a partner program so that the spouses, the wives of men who are struggling with these issues, get a support system. And so we offer that as well. It's called Partners in Process. Our men's program, by the way, is called Homecoming. Our Homecoming is the name of our men's program. And then we also offer coaching and counseling. So Sam Louie, who you're going to speak to here in a few minutes, Sam is a mental health counselor. I'm also a mental health counselor. We offer mental health counseling services in the state of Washington for men and partners, as well as for couples. So, as you know, you've spoken at our conferences, the Higher Men's Conference in Bellevue, Washington, as well as we have a conference for women affected partners called Partners in Process.
That's great.
Pardon me, called Restoring Hearts.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Steve. Yeah, we love what you guys are doing at Prodigals, and we've been doing ministry alongside each other for a long, long time now. And it's exciting to see the longevity and just the expansion of y'all's reach, especially with what you're doing through some of your group ministry and some of the online things that you guys are able to offer now. I want to transition to hearing Sam's story. Well, let's start with Sam. Sam, why don't you share a little bit with us about first of all, let's talk about how you got connected to Prodigals, and then let's unpack your story that led to the book that you have written. And we'll talk more later about how folks can get the book, but let's just kind of unpack your journey.
Sure. Steve and I used to work together at a place in Bellevue at a group practice that specialized in sex addiction and sex offense work. And then through the years, I was bouncing around various clinics, started up my own private practice. And I think right before COVID, somehow had an opportunity to reconnect with Steve, and the conversation led to, like, is there a need if I came along and helped out with other extra clients that may come through Prodigal's way? Since I already had an office in Bellevue, they could either see me there or offer or see me virtually.
Mm-hmm. And so let's talk about your story, because you have a pretty interesting story that has a very unique angle to it that sometimes doesn't get addressed in the entire recovery community. And so can you talk about your personal story of recovery and why it's a little bit unique?
Yeah, it's highlighted in the title of the book, Passport to Pain, from Asian immigrant to American addict. My parents were immigrants from Hong Kong. And when we moved to South Seattle, I was about 4 or 5 years old. Excuse me. So my parents were already in their late 20s, early 30s, and they come from a very traditional Chinese background. They didn't know any English. So when we immigrated, I'm trying to understand the tension of what does it mean to still honor the heritage I grew up in, this Asian collectivist worldview where the group slash the family is honored above all else. And then I'm moving to a Western society that prides itself on individualism, right? Speak up. We want to know your thoughts, how you feel about certain things, you know, in class, raise your hand. We want to hear critical thinking skills, whereas on the home front, everything was just listen and obey. Listen and obey. We don't want you to have any thoughts that are contrary to what the parent or parents or the culture has instilled in my parents through ancestors through centuries.
Mm-hmm. And then when
so that's kind of the background.
yeah. And then how did that then lead to addiction? Like, what did that look like? How did that get birthed in your life?
Yeah. The other piece of identity I should be, I want the audience to be aware of, it was more than just mainstream America and understanding my Asian background. When we immigrated to South Seattle, which at the time was primarily an African-American neighborhood. So I'm trying to understand, what does it mean to fit in? I'm trying to fit into mainstream America that I see on TV. I want to fit into Black society that I'm encountering every day at school. And I'm also trying to fit in at school. And in a lot of, mental health understanding of immigrant experiences or minorities is this desire to fit in, right? I want to fit in. I want to be accepted. So to do that, I'll speak for myself. I hid a lot of my Asian parts, right? I didn't like that ethnic side of me. So much so, if it's helpful, I'll just read one short paragraph that might give the audience an understanding of what this really means in terms of trying to hide myself. I hate myself. This was one of my earliest thoughts as a Chinese boy in the United States. I wasn't white like those I saw on television. I wasn't Black like those in my neighborhood. I was an Asian immigrant. I was an outsider, a foreigner, the other. It was 1976 and I was 4 years old. I hated looking differently, speaking different, and having different customs and traditions from mainstream America. So as young as I can remember, there was this internal struggle of accepting myself, self-hatred, self-loathing of myself, my culture, and really wanting to minimize this so I could fit in to the rest of society.
And where did that then dovetail, or where did you see that maybe as a foundation for what might have eventually led to porn addiction or some other addictive behaviors?
Yeah, early on, you know, looking back, I could see it as compulsive or addictive. But, you know, as a kid, you didn't think much of it. There was a lot of, fantasy. I'm not talking about sexual fantasy at the time. There was just a lot of escape type of activities where I wanted to escape. So our parents worked long hours. My dad was a cook at the time. My mom was a waitress. I was the oldest of three. So we kind of just had to entertain ourselves. Watched hours and hours of TV, lots of video games, both at home and at the arcade. You know, anything you could do, comic books, you're just engrossing yourself in any type of escapist behavior, fantasy, that, you know, in right amounts, it would have been healthy, but I did not realize I was carrying some of what I mentioned earlier, the internalized shame, but also my own fears of growing up in America, like, well, what is this all going to be? Because I'm the first one from three generations down to go through the American school system. And my parents could barely speak English. So everything, I was kind of their interpreter. So I was carrying so many roles, especially being the oldest as well. trying to be a role model for my two younger brothers, that there is this unspoken weight upon me that I had to figure it out, be an example of what it meant to be, quote, a success in America. So that weight led me, I think, to continue to find ways to just numb out that pressure through those various forms of early, you know, just doing anything compulsively, right? Even sports, like I'm just playing sports compulsively on the playground by myself. It didn't matter. And then I, you know, right around puberty, you know, at the time my parents would get these, you know, just regular department store catalogs. And even then that was a way where I would just look at all the different things that I wish I could have. Like, let me circle this electronic gadget or this sporting equipment or whatever, highlight the description. And that was it. I wish I could have it. What would it be like to have this? As I entered puberty, that catalog became more intriguing because then I realized, oh, they even have these lingerie sections, right? I didn't circle the models or anything, but I definitely looked at the lingerie models and like, oh, wow, this is another place, just another area where the prior compulsive template could go. Let me just fantasize. What would it be to be with this woman or have this woman care for me?
Mm-hmm. And then what did the beginnings of recovery look like? And how did that then kind of lead you to the work you're even doing today?
Well, before recovery, there was the full-blown addiction, right? So, you know, high school, there wasn't a lot, primarily because I just dove into sports and just tried to just, you know, I didn't really think about girls. The other piece was I didn't think anybody would like me because ethnically, you know, I'm Asian. So then it wasn't into college. College, there are a lot of, I got into, I wouldn't call them relationships. They were one night stands because I didn't think anybody would want to be with me. One night could have lasted 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but they were short term relationships because I thought, gosh, if I stick around in this relationship for too long, this woman is going to find me wanting in some way. They're going to find something deficient in me. Better to just end this quasi relationship sooner rather than later and get hurt because, you know, if I stick around for too long, she's going to realize there's something really terrible with me and I'm just not good enough for her. So a lot of one night stands. And then my first career was in broadcast journalism. So I moved away from home, started in Montana, and then continued to move to the Midwest and Ohio. And, you know, at the, you know, this is all uncharted territory. Post-college, what am I supposed to do? How do I, quote, succeed in this field? A lot of fears. Television journalism, I was a news reporter. It was intense. Like there's a lot of deadlines. There's a lot of performance anxiety, Sam. You got to be live at noon. You got to be live at 5, got to be live at 6, not only completing it in time, but the fear of, am I going to flub on live TV? And so that just fueled the, because I was in this pressure cooker, I didn't really have time to look for relationships as much. So pornography became an easy access to ward off these feelings of inadequacies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then, so then where did that go? When did you finally start realizing
this is a problem?
That, yeah, I have a problem that I'm not able to just quit anytime I want.
Yeah. At the time in Ohio, I met a woman, Korean American woman. And she was my first wife. We got married, but during the premarital counseling, I remember the retired church psychologist asked, like, hey, is there anything else we should know about you? And I said, well, you know, I do look at images. You know, I do look at things. And like, what do you mean? And then I shared about the pornography piece. And this was back in late 90s. So the understanding within the therapy therapeutic community wasn't very strong. And I remember he was also retired for many years too. So this is all new to him. He's like, well, his assignment was this, let's just flood the system. Sam, why don't you just look at as much porn as, just get it out of your system now. That was like his premarital counseling advice. And in my head, I'm like, yes, I think this guy is deluding himself. Even then, with no understanding of addiction, I'm like, this is not the right recipe. Right. So then I continued on. It went underground. And a few years later, I still remember it clearly to this day. I was working a swing shift. I'm on the 11 o'clock news. I get home around midnight. I'm downloading the day and, my fears, insecurities, because Los Angeles is like the media capital, at least the entertainment capital of the world. So a lot of pressure. And the stakes are high because you're getting paid well to perform well. And so I kind of numbed out. I believe I was numbing out every night. By this time, my wife was always asleep. She happened to wake up to use the restroom and then caught me looking at online pornography on the computer and was aghast. And that's when, when they talk about the pit of the stomach feeling happening, that's what happened. And I was like in shock, I think, for the next 6 months, because by then it was a whirlwind of activity of understanding, wow, this is a problem. I need to get help. And then eventually my then wife filed for divorce because it was just too overwhelming for her as well.
Mm-hmm. And then what did recovery look like and kind of brought you to a place where you then wanted to go into the mental health field yourself?
Yeah. There were no formalized, at least I didn't know, but I found a good Christian male, two Christian male therapists. One was individual therapy, and then somehow I think he knew of another therapist who ran groups for men, and they didn't call it like, hey, this is a sex addiction group. They just said, hey, I run a group with other guys that are dealing with a similar problem. Would you be interested? So I remember the individual counseling was hard because it was just difficult for me from my background to get help of that nature. It was like a mark of dishonor to the family. Mm-hmm. So I didn't tell my parents I'm getting help. I didn't tell my parents what was going on that led to the divorce. But when I went to the group therapy, I think that was very life-changing for me. As much as individual was imperative, the group therapy was very life-altering, because from day one, I could still remember the body, obviously having some fear, like, what is this going to be with all these different people? I'm not like them. I'm better than them. These guys are perverts. Back then is how I saw everyone, but I'm normal. I'm the normal guy. I'm the educated guy. They were educated too, but in my head, I'm like, I'm the healthy one. I'm the healthy one with the problem. These guys are just weirdos with the problem. But the group helps synthesize and help me realize, wow, normal people like me and them can have these problems that I felt were so abnormal. And through a couple years of that group therapy, that really altered my understanding of myself. My culture started getting woven into the understanding of the addiction. And eventually, I was still in journalism at the time because, that's what I knew. And God just kept kind of pressing into me, because the stories that I would promote at the station were all starting to become recovery related. Like, hey, why don't we do a story about men's mental health or Christian recovery or this or that. And my boss would say, hey, Sam, you're doing all these stories or pitching all these stories about mental health, addiction, recovery. Have you ever thought about going into this field? And so then a little light bulb turned on, but it took a few more years for me to finally like, okay, am I really going to give up what I had known for, you know, over a decade to go into the unknown? But I did. And that was, you know, back in almost 15, 16 years ago is when I finally made the switch.
Yeah, that's great. I'm going to push the pause there for a second. And let's, Fausto, let's go to you. You know, I think it's going to be interesting because we've gotten one cultural perspective from Sam on his story. I think we're going to be able to get another cultural perspective from you on your story. So can you give us a little bit of your own background of addiction and recovery and how you've gotten to this, this great opportunity to provide a Spanish language support group for men?
Sure. And thank you so much, Jonathan. So it all started, I'm Latino. I grew up in Honduras. And so my mom and dad got together when they were so young. They were like 19 and 17, and they had me. So dad had to provide since a very young age. And my mom, you know, was, you know, looking after me, but at the same time, she was trying to make an ends meet. I mean, she had to work as well because they were so young. And in our culture, the problem that we have is that men have multiple women, you know, and that is just a fact. I mean, and it's unexpected things to happen, you know. I mean, you typically have men who will have like multiple marriages and it's not legal, but they do have like 2, 3, 4 women. You see what I mean? With multiple children on each family, and they just do and live like that, you know? And so it is breaking people's heart all the time, multiple times. But the problem is that you live in that consistent, how can I say it, in that consistent lost environment, right? I mean, so what happens is my dad was suspecting of me, you know, Fausto, you should, you know, consider before getting married, you should consider at least sleeping with 100 women. You must. I mean, that is the goal. The goal is before you get married, you need to have slept with these many women. And so that expectation, obviously, the more women you have, the more of a man you become. And he modeled it. He modeled it. And it was unfortunate because he did break my mom's heart multiple times. And he learned it from his dad, and his dad learned it from his dad. So it is a generational thing, but it's also a cultural thing. You know, I mean, it's not unnormal to see a man who has kids with another woman and then him bringing those kids along to kind of meet, you know, from time to time. And then some of the women, they try to, you know, live like that, but they are unhappy. And my mom was one of them, you know. I do remember, and I do recall seeing my mom brokenhearted multiple times. So as a kid, me growing up like that, understanding that, yes, I mean, men do that thing, you know, they do have multiple women, they do, you know, indulge into lust, you know, and it's considered a social pattern and a social, you know, a new standard, you know, in our system, if you put it that way. So starting from there, understanding that Latin culture is like about, you know, the more women you have, the better it is. Men, you know, have multiple women, sometimes even multiple, I'll say homes, you know, and that was the environment and the expectation. On top of all of that, the expectation from my dad on me. So before you get married, you don't do that, you know, go get go virgin until you get married. No, I mean, you gotta sleep around with multiple women before you commit to someone fully. How does that entail, and how does my addiction develop from there? Well, pornography is a thing that is not as hidden as it should, because the problem is, it's not that it is fully exposed, because it's a Catholic country, so you will not see post of, you know, naked woman anywhere, like everywhere, sorry. But you will know that people have it in their homes, right? So what ended up happening is I started finding porn in, you know, my grandpa's, you know, secret room. I would see posters on my cousin's, you know, bedroom, you know, of naked women. And so that started, you know, since I was like 5-6 years old, right? So I remember seeing my first Playboy when I was like probably 9 to 10 years old. I remember I stole a bunch of them, you know, from my grandpa, and I brought them to my hometown. And, you know, I was the coolest kid ever, because I had this thing, right? And I had, you know, porn, you know, and it was accessible. It was, you know, it was a real thing. One day my dad gave me a computer, who bought from a friend, and I was already 12 when that happened. And he bought a computer from a friend of his, and that computer came with a bunch of CDs. And I was into video gaming, and I was playing video games, and that video game that my dad bought for me, I already had finished it. So I just wanted to play more games. I went through, you know, all of the CDs, and I saw one with 3 X's on it. I thought it was the Vin Diesel Triple X movie. Maybe, you know, they had made a game about that movie. I thought, oh, this is going to be so cool. And to my surprise, when I opened that CD, I mean, yeah, it was something completely different. I saw, like, you know, multiple, you know, pornographic videos on that CD. At first I got scared, but hey, my dad gave me this computer. So maybe my dad is expecting me to actually do this, you know, and if my dad gave it to me, maybe this is the right thing to see. Maybe the adults look at this, right? Maybe I'm not going to tell anybody about this, but if my dad gave it to me, it must be good. Right. So I think that's how like my cultural and how I started into pornography can be bridged.
And so then when what did the journey look like from there to the point where you eventually started to say, this is not right. This is not good. I've got to do something about this.
I was such a good student in school. I mean, it's not bragging. I was really good at school. But the moment I started, you know, consuming pornography, I started noticing that my, you know, I was getting slower, right? I would consume pornography, you know, since that moment I started watching porn. You can count that I was probably masturbating at least 5 to 6 times per day, you know, at the age of, you know, 14, I was already looking at pornography for no less than 3 to 4 hours a day. You know, and it was a ton of pornography for a kid, and nobody knew about it. Nobody would catch me, because my mom didn't know how to use the computer. She wouldn't know how to find like secret files or hidden files. My dad wasn't present all the time, so it was me and this big secret of me. And you know, obviously at the age of 16, 17, you want to, you know, put into practice what you learned. So I got this girlfriend, and we started having sexual intercourse, right? And then unfortunately, she got pregnant, and I said, I'm not responsible. I'm just not going to be present. And so she had an abortion. I obviously got scared. I was 17, 18 years old. I saw how my dad and my mom got together like so young. I didn't want to be a part of that again. I didn't want to bring a kid that would suffer, because my mom and dad, you know, would have so many problems, like so many issues. My dad would cheat on my mom all the time. My dad had other kids out of, you know, the wedlock and out of the marriage. And that destroyed our family completely. And I just didn't want to do that. I just didn't want to deal with any of that pain. So I hid, you know, that issue. And I went and got my girlfriend to have an abortion. Then I left her. Then I went to have more sex with other women and got another girlfriend pregnant, and then did the same thing, because I did it once. So now I'm going to do it twice. So this is another girlfriend, you know, with another abortion. So now it's 2 babies, right? And then I'm like, I have to, you know, make some changes. I mean, I can't keep doing this, but at the same time, I couldn't control myself. At the age of 21, I met this girl. Same thing. She got pregnant again. But the problem now is like, you know what? I'm going to try to be better. I'm not going to get her to do an abortion. I'm going to marry this girl. And I thought that, you know, just making the decision in my mind that I needed to just to, you know, engage to someone, maybe that could be the solution and the problem taker, right? And so I decided to marry her. And what ended up happening is a year after, we got divorced, we unfortunately lost the baby. She had a miscarriage, and that obviously broke her heart, made the relationship even tougher. And, you know, we couldn't keep up the marriage. I mean, she left me within a year, and, you know, and I was cheating on her constantly. I was a monster. I tried to stop. I didn't know what to do. I got to the point of, you know, becoming a suicidal individual. My parents found out because I bought a life insurance policy. So they found out, you know, what my intentions were. And so at that time, my dad had started, you know, attending to a church. And so he came to talk to me, and he told me about his relationship with Jesus, which at the beginning, you know, it was like, okay, good for you. I mean, it's good for you. I mean, I'm glad that you found something, but sad for me. But at the same time, I mean, something that he told me that day struck me, and he said, you know, I'm sorry. I'm just so sorry. I screwed up. I hurt you, and man, I just don't want you to go through all this. And so that, you know, I saw a sincere man for the first time in my life. You know, I saw a man who was, you know, apologizing, you know. And so I remember he said, go to Canada, move to Canada. You can't stay in Honduras. I had already become a permanent resident of Canada. So he said, move to Canada. I know something good will come out of this. And so I moved to Canada. And I thought, okay, maybe new country, new Fausto, and I'm not going to have this addiction again. Well, the addiction got even worse because in Canada, it was more liberal. And so now, you know, finding sex and finding women who wanted to have sex without any commitment was even easier. And I just couldn't stop. But then one day, I remember I felt so empty. I felt so lonely. I attended to a church. And then I just thought about my dad, because my dad said I went to a church, and how it works is you go to a church and then you just get baptized. Make sure you get baptized. And then, you know, you start reading a Bible and you start doing that. And so I remember I started doing all of those things, but the problem wouldn't go away. It was my secret. And a year and a half, probably 2 years into church, my pastor one day mentions the subject of addiction to porn. I was like, maybe, you know, maybe I do have a problem. Maybe I don't. And so I tried to stop for that week. I'm like, okay, I'm going to do a test and let's see how long I can take it. I mean, if I can last a week without porn, I am not an addict. I lasted probably 7 hours. And so that's when I realized, okay, I have a big freaking problem. I mean, this is not going to be an easy thing. A year into, you know, me realizing that I met this girl, I married her. And from that day onwards, I decided I will not sleep with other women, which I haven't since that day, but I couldn't stop porn and masturbating. I just couldn't. There was no way. I tried everything. I even told her, before even getting married, I told her, like, listen, I have this problem. I cannot stop watching porn. And she said, let's fight together. Let's deal with this together. Let's try to find a solution. And we did so many things. Listen, I read books. I attended several conferences. I went to a psychologist. I met counselors, and nothing would work. And so I was just desperate. First child comes in, and I'm still an addict. And then my second boy comes in, and I'm still an addict. I remember one day she asked me to look after the boy. I left the boy in the bed, and then I went to the washroom to watch porn. And then, you know, I remember when I got out of the washroom, she was just waiting for me outside. It's just like, I can't believe that you cannot even watch your own son for like 20 minutes without you having, you know, to compulsively go to the washroom to masturbate because you need to watch porn. We have a problem here and we need to solve it. And I didn't know what to do. At that time, a friend of mine invited me to an XCC. It's an extreme character challenge. It's a big hike with, you know, it's a Christian event. So you go there with 100 men in the middle of the bush, you know, and you just go through a long, you know, and exhausting, you know, hike, if you put it that way. You have to bring everything with you. It was my first time camping. It was my first time backpacking. It was my first time doing a hike like that. It was miserable. I hated it. But on one of the days, I mean, one of the men touched on the subject of addiction. They did mention that. And I do remember asking, okay, how do you get rid of it? I did ask about that because that was my biggest issue. And I just haven't had an opportunity to be free from it. I wanted to feel and experience at least 1 month without being an addict. You see what I mean? And nothing would work. And I just asked the questions and nothing would work. And I was just desperate, man. I was just desperate and I just didn't know what to do. And the man at that place, one of the men there said, you know, I mean, at the end of the hike, we'll tell you about a group that has helped multiple men and we'll just tell you, you know, how it works and just be patient. That was day two. I was so expectant. I was expecting that man to come and find me and to tell me about this group because I, for some reason, thought like if I came all the way here to hike 50 kilometers and I'm going to find an answer, you know, to my problem, this is the place where I want to be. And I'm going to finish this with hope. Now, for some reason, that gave me a bit of hope, you know, during my hike. Fourth day comes in. I asked the man, okay, so can you tell me the number? The guy just gave me one email. And as soon as I came to Calgary, that's the first thing I did. I just went in and I just wrote to this man. His name is Darian. And I remember, you know, emailing him about, hey, I have a problem. Is there a solution here? I mean, please let me know what to do. He connected with me like 2 days later. Then he told me about the online group in Calgary. And the program was called Homecoming Prodigals International. It was great. I mean, at first, it was a little weird because, you know, they needed to improve their slides. They were like from the 70s. And oh my goodness, it was like, okay, this is very, very strange. And all of the men were so quiet. And it was like if you had killed someone, like, you know, it felt more like a funeral instead of a recovery group. But anyways, I mean, I just saw these men, you know, being transparent. And okay, so I thought to myself, maybe, you know, I have tried, you know, good gadgets and Covenant Eyes and multiple things, and they did help, but did not solve the problem. My problem wasn't, you know, just pornography. My problem was a change in my heart and my mind. I needed that, and I just didn't know how to get it. And so, as soon as I talked to Darian for my first meeting, he did mention to me, okay, there are requirements for you to jump into a sobriety group. Okay, for some reason, I completely neglected the part that I needed to read 3 books and the part that I needed to do, you know, reflections on those books and put insights in it. And there was a lot of work into it. So I just didn't know. I just thought, okay, maybe I have to just attend 4 meetings, being sober for 30 days. I did not know how to achieve that, but I'm going to try my best. I tried my best. I slipped a couple of times, but I'm like, okay, they don't need to know this. Maybe I'm going to lie that I, you know, have, you know, been sober for 30 days and I'm going to get into that recovery group. 4 meeting goes in and I said to everyone, okay, I'm ready. Get me into my sobriety group. I haven't received your 30 insights. Have you read the 3 books? And that's when I realized, oh, okay, this is going to be tougher than I thought. And yeah, I remember, you know, being discouraged for that meeting. But one of the men, you know, who was recently connecting again, because he had recently moved to another city, his name is Alex. He followed up with me and phoned me. He spoke Spanish to me, and that was a news. That was a new to me because, speaking a Spanish-speaking folk here. And he was a mentor for over 10 years. Alex, he phoned me, and we started talking about my addiction, my journey, my problem. And he said, listen, I think you should stay, because I felt discouraged. I just didn't know if it was the right place for me, because there was so much work. And I have a job. I had two kids. I had a wife. And you know, all of the things, you know, that I could put before this program. So I had the perfect excuse for not taking it, right? So, but Alex encouraged me and said, listen, at the end of the day, I'm going to be very open and honest with you. You will lose that perfect job, you will lose that perfect woman, you will lose that perfect family if you don't get healed. If you don't get healed, eventually everything will collapse on you because your foundation is wrong and you need to change your foundation. And so he said that, he confronted me in a way, and I decided, okay, I'm gonna try. I did end up finishing the three books and getting into the sobriety group. And then once I got into the sobriety group, it was even worse than entering into the mentoring group, you know, into the sobriety group. It was terrible. So much homework. I hated Alex. I freaking hated that. I told him one day, Alex, you are an ass and I hate you with all my heart. And I did mean it. I was like, you are not a nice man. You are not kind to me. You don't see that I have problems. You don't see that I have financial burdens. You don't see that I have a family. And he said, man, I am here to help you. And I could care less about those things unless you are healed. That's what he said to me. I hated him for that. At the beginning, you know, the first months, I yell at him at the group. I yell at him, and I don't feel proud of that, but I was just so angry, you know, and he said, listen, I remember him telling me this, you can yell at me all you want, but the only reason you are here is because of you. You are the only problem here. So you have the problem. I'm trying to help you. You're not paying me to do this. So, you know, I'm here to help you, but if you don't want to be helped, find your way. And so I decided to stay. Step one goes through, and then the unexpected thing happens. I am trying to be sober, right? I am trying to live an honest life, okay? I am trying. And for the first time in my life, I see like one whole month, like in a different reality. Then the second month goes by, step number two, and I'm 2 months into sobriety. And then step three goes by, and then I'm 3 months into sobriety. 6 months into sobriety. And I am just a different man altogether. You see what I mean? And it was the first time in my life where I could see something working. And it wasn't easy. But it was 6 months.
Yeah, that's huge. Yeah.
And then I finished the program. It's 12 steps. I would say 12 steps, 12 months. And so then I am on my step 12 and I see a year of sobriety. It's the first time in my life where I can see such a milestone. After 22 years of addiction, and it's my first time, you know, me having something meaningful in my life. And so that's
good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's so good. I think all of us on this call can relate to those feelings. because we've all had those breakthroughs. And that's what we want our audience to hear and see, is that even if you have tried and tried and failed and tried and failed and up and down and just all these, what we might call false starts, the persistence is worth it. The Alexes of the world are worth it. You know, those guys that are willing to get in your face. And that's what I want to say here, you know, to all of you, Steve, Sam, Fausto, you guys are now paying it forward because of what has been poured into your life. And I think that's so important. Now, for the sake of time, I want us to be able to talk very quickly and briefly about, Sam, I'd love for you to share about your book and how people can get connected to that. Fausto, I would love for you to be able to share about what has come of your story and being able to now offer a Spanish language group for men. So Sam, share about your book and how people can get connected with that.
The book Passport to Shame, from Asian Immigrant to American Addict, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, any online retailer. There are some local bookstores or smaller book in-person retailers that may sell them, but you can go online to get it.
Yeah, and what is who is that book really targeted at? Who do you feel like is going to what are you trying to communicate through that our audience may be able to benefit from?
Well, I wanted anybody who either A, struggles with addiction, those who are in the helping professions, pastors, teachers, people who interact with Asian cultures in any capacity, or those who just want to understand a bit more about immigrant experiences and minority mental health.
That's great. Yeah, we will definitely post or point to that. And Fausto, share with us what you're doing now, which is so exciting to be able to say, hey, now that you've been experiencing sobriety, what are you doing to help especially Spanish speaking men?
Yeah, no. So as soon as I finish my 12 step, I mean, the step is essentially encouraging you to go and reach to others and support others as well. So obviously I told my pastor about it and he said, okay, is it in Spanish? I said, no. And so immediately, okay, that's a big problem here. Because not all of the men that come to my church, you know, speak the language. I went to Colombia to speak to a pastor and I told him my whole story. I told him my whole journey. And he said, listen, you should talk about it. Let's talk about it in my church. I did a presentation for 200 men in Colombia. And it was powerful. I told my story. And then he immediately said to me, hey, man, I think God is calling you to come and translate all that stuff. Because, I mean, there is no English speaking folk here in Colombia right now. So I think you need to make that gap, you need to bridge that gap by doing something. So, yeah, I needed to get that, you know, going. And I spoke to Alex. Alex spoke Spanish as well. He said yes, and then we decided to start the Prodigals, you know, in Espanol, the Prodigals Homecoming, you know, in Espanol for Spanish-speaking folks. We meet every Wednesday at 7 p.m., you know, Mountain Standard Time. So what we are doing is we are now on our second sobriety group. They just started two Wednesdays ago. So it is very exciting. The first sobriety group that, you know, we started with 16 men. Out of those 16 men, four completed the program. So those four men are co-mentoring right now with Alex and myself. So very, very powerful.
Yeah. Yeah. That's super exciting. I'm so glad to hear that. And Steve, why don't you share with our listeners, all right, where can they go to get everything Prodigals, like to learn about all of your resources?
We have a lot of resources. Prodigalsinternational.org is our website. And we have, you know, there's links up there to our groups, obviously to the Spanish group, if there's interest in the Spanish group. We have the online Saturday morning meeting for our international meeting that we do online. We have lots of resources. there's recently we actually posted a Blue Sky Recovery Series, which is a mental health series, an 8-part series that's free for men and men's mental health, that's available also on our website. So we have lots of resources on the website. And they can contact us we'd be happy to give them support and give them help and make recommendations, regardless of what their needs are, whether they're in need of counseling, coaching, in-person groups, or if they're in need of online resources. And we have a lot of, like I said, online as well for our support groups.
That's so good. Well, I just want to say thank you to you guys for getting up early for this interview and for what you guys are doing in this space of ministry. And thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thanks, Jonathan.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Yeah. Well, listeners and viewers, we're going to put a lot of info in the show notes. There's been a lot of good resources that have been talked about today, but I also want to highlight what I hope you heard today, and that is the power of story. We want to help you take your next best step towards wholeness in Christ so that your story can be also a story of redemption, a story of healing. So please reach out to us, and we look forward to seeing you back here again next time on the Pure Sex Radio program. Take care.